Ask your questions directly by calling Collect, Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311, or in the New York area, 866-5010. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. We continue our week-long look at the question, what are we doing in Vietnam? So far this week, we have heard our official foreign policy position stated by a State Department spokesman. We have heard an outspoken critic of our military and civilian actions say that we are losing the war in both areas. And we have heard a congressional hawk say we are not losing the war, but that if we had gone in strength to begin with, we would have won it by now. Tonight, another outspoken critic. When the Defense Department saw his book, there was a very real question raised as to whether or not they would allow Lieutenant Colonel William Corson to retire from the Marine Corps after 25 years of service. They did allow him to retire, and his book, The Betrayal, was published one day later. It deals mostly with the other war, the war for the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. Tuesday night's guest, William Lederer, wrote the introduction, and here is a portion of it. Colonel Corson shows that the United States' efforts in the other war are almost a total failure, that the United States is being defeated. He demonstrates that the causes of failure are, 1, South Vietnamese governmental corruption, 2, the acquiescence of the United States in this corruption, 3, incompetence and petty bureaucratic rivalry, 4, the narrow vision of the U.S. military establishment, and 5, the refusal to accept unwelcome facts, a self-inflicted blindness that extends from the top of our government to remote field commanders. Here are a few quotes from Colonel Carson's book, The Betrayal. The bombing of the North is indefensible, strategically, tactically, and politically. The South Vietnamese army rapes, loots, and pillages in the manner of a conqueror rather than a protector. The peasant believes he is subject to more danger and violence from the South Vietnamese army than from the Viet Cong. Until just before the Tet Offensive, Colonel Corson had been in charge of the successful pacification program of the Marine Corps Combined Action Platoons, which actually lived in the South Vietnamese hamlets they were assigned to protect. He and his Marines incurred the enmity of the government of South Vietnam and our own military, both of whom frowned on his unorthodox methods, which, very simply stated, were, have nothing to do with the government or Army of South Vietnam. Also avoid as much as possible contact with Americans who are advisors to them, and be honest in your dealings with the Vietnamese people. Colonel Corson is standing by now to answer your questions and share your comments and conversation on what are we doing in Vietnam. Our national telephone number is area code 212-749-3311. You may call us Collect nationally at 212-749-3311. In the New York area, you may call us at 866-5010. That's local calls again on 866-5010. Colonel Carson, good evening.
Good evening, Del.
Our first question, sir. Why are we losing the other war, the one for the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people?
Well, as I've tried to say in the betrayal, the reason for the loss is very complex. I think that if you wanted to sum it up in a single phrase, is that high national reputations have been placed on the line of a conception of the way the world should go, and because we're trying to validate these particular individuals' position of the world and of Vietnam in particular, that we have pursued a course of action that just isn't productive. I mean, that's it in a nutshell, and it's a question of facing the reality, the circumstances that actually obtain in Vietnam, and this has not been done by the high officials in the Johnson administration.
When your book was about to be published, the Pentagon decided, or there was talk, that they would hold up your discharge. What decided, or what was reasons at the last moment to decide to let your discharge go through?
Well, I think that when we came down to the, to use the Rusk metaphor, to the real crunch, the final decision to allow me to retire after 25 and a half years service was based upon the pressure that came from the people in terms of the public outrage at attempting to silence me and to suppress the publication of the book, fact that the legislative branch of the government, members of Congress, felt that this was an intolerable act by the administration, and they were willing to oppose the administration in this regard. And so the administration backed off, and I was allowed to retire.
In your book, you state that each American fighting man experiences a culture shock after his first confrontation with the enemy in Vietnam. Would you explain?
Well, as you know, Americans feel very superior to other people around the world. I mean, we have, even in our own nation, a series of cultural imbalances, the attitude of the so-called white racist and the Negro. And when they come into contact, I mean, the American fighting man specifically comes into contact with this enemy that he's been told to deprecate, and his whole cultural background is such to deprecate the communist and to deprecate the Oriental. He's small, he's sort of insignificant, and he believes in an alien ideology. And when he finds that this guy is tough, he's shrewd, and he believes quite conclusively in what he's fighting for, that this comes as quite a shock to the American, who thinks that he's some sort of a chained robot. And he finds that the man believes just as strongly in what he's fighting for as the individual American does, and he fights well. So this creates what I call a culture shock.
The other war in Vietnam, and again quoting from your book, has been proclaimed as the struggle to promote economic and political self-sufficiency in the South. And the Johnson administration has said that unless this war is won, the U.S. will not achieve its purpose, even though it might achieve a military victory.
Now, that acknowledgement has been made openly, and I think that there is even a rich metaphor within the United States. We talk about the achievement of the American dream, and we talk about the promotion of economic equality in our own nation. Without this, why, America may become the most powerful, or is the most powerful nation, and will remain the most powerful nation. But this is paying lip service to an ideal and very little effort, an insignificant amount of the effort of the American activity in Vietnam is directed to promoting this particular goal. And I think that the metaphor, not the metaphor, but the analogy is apt in the United States. We talk a great deal about promoting the equality of opportunity, but then when you come down to the $170 billion that's spent by the federal government, how little of that amount of funds is actually used for this particular purpose.
Last night, our guest was Congressman Hebert, who stated that if we were to leave Vietnam within the foreseeable future, that we could hope to be there, or not hope to be there, but we could expect to be there for at least 14 to 15 years. Do you agree with his analysis?
Well, there are two thresholds to this question. I think that the congressman, well, he can have whatever opinion that he chooses to hold. We have made such a damaging effect upon the entire culture and the economy of Vietnam, that to repair the damage that we have caused to the people, to the families, to the children, to the women, to the entire social fabric, it would take 14 or 15 years of conscious effort on our part to repair the damage. Now, the conclusion of the military campaign, I would say that the Viet Cong could be, and this might sound very extreme, but I think that the Viet Cong could be removed as a military threat within a framework of 12 to 18 months.
Colonel Carson, we'll begin accepting some calls from our night call listeners, and we'll take our first call from Kingston, Pennsylvania. Mr. Schaefer is hearing night call over WBAX in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Welcome to night call, sir.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Is General Corson?
Yes, right here.
All right, General Corson.
It's just Colonel. I never made General. I had to leave before that happened.
All right. Do you find any similarity between the type of war that we're fighting in Vietnam and the type of war that we fought in Korea?
Well, Mr. Schaefer, I fought in Korea, and I found that when I fought in Vietnam in the operations in the DMZ in 1966 and also in 1967, that those operations were very similar. These were conventional military operations, and in the very narrow constraint of your question, yes, when we fought it in the area of Khe Sanh in 1967, these battles were very similar to the battles that we fought in Korea and also in World War II.
All right. Now, in view of the present overt military activities of North Korea against South Korea, which is due mainly to the failure of the economic and social plans of a North Korean government, this is since Panmunjom, do you believe that a settlement of the Vietnam War at the Paris Peace Conference will eventually lead also to a similar crisis?
No, I think that when you look at the entirety of Asia, Mr. Schaefer, you find that, and this is, there is a very subtle distinction in the so-called domino theory. Vietnam possesses a very unique characteristic. It has a degree of racial purity that doesn't obtain in any other nation in Asia, to include Korea, as a matter of fact. That the Vietnamese are ethnically and racially pure from a standpoint that there hasn't been the intertwining of the various races that have been involved. Now, realize that in Vietnam, the Chinese were in Vietnam going back to the period of the Yuan Dynasty. This is the 13th century. But intermarriage did not take place, and a cultural crossbreeding did not take place. And so the Vietnamese remained relatively pure from a cultural and a racial and an ethnic point of view. Now, in Korea, to contrast this, you find that the Japanese were there since 1895, and there was a considerable amount of intermarriage. There was a considerable amount of a cross-fertilization of the ideas of the Japanese and the Koreans. Now, to assume, or to take your question to its furthest point, if we achieve a settlement at Paris or some other location, it's quite likely that Vietnam will emerge as an individual nation. Now, how this will work out, I mean, there are a lot of ramifications to this, but because of this racial purity, and you find that in both the North and the South, and I've been in both the North and the South, there is one unifying factor beyond the fact that they're Vietnamese. They dislike the Chinese with an intensity that perhaps is equal to the dislike of the Poles and the Germans or some antagonistic elements in the United States, for example.
Therefore, you think that is going to be basically a socially binding force between the North and the South Vietnam versus North Korea and South Korea?
That's right. You find in Vietnam parochialism or regionalism, and this is mixing the metaphor a little bit, not too badly, I hope, but you find that they are all Vietnamese, as in Italy, they're all Italians, but there's a substantial difference between the people who live in the Delta, for example, and those who live in the Central Highlands, the northern provinces of South Vietnam, and even up in Hanoi. But they do have a strong antagonism, and I can't overstress it, they have a strong antagonism to the Chinese. And this has been, more than any single factor, responsible for the degree of restraint in the prosecution of the war, because the Chinese have been willing to be much more helpful than the North Vietnamese have allowed them to be.
I see. Now, this is rather interesting, but I did have one other point, and I want other callers to get in. But to press the idea further, this being so, the relationship between the Chinese ideas and that of the North Koreans, with the instruction of Ho Chi Minh very early in his days, I believe in China itself, learning to become a communist, how has the North Korean government been able to camouflage this fact, and how have they been able to, from the standpoint of North Korean communism, how are they differentiating this between Chinese communism?
Well,
Colonel Carson, I'm going to ask if you'd be kind enough to hold your answer back until station identification. And Mr. Schaefer, if you'd like to stay on the line, you may. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Colonel William Carson after station identification. In our city and state, and all across the United States, people are talking about trouble. Black and white trouble. Some call it racial tension, or see poverty as the real problem. Or say law and order has given way to anarchy in our streets. Most people agree, at least, that there is a crisis. And we are a people with many unanswered questions. This station believes you deserve to ask your own questions and get some answers, or at least opinions, from people who should know what they're talking about. So we bring you Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show where you ask your questions and express your opinions to leaders such as John Lindsay, Ralph Abernathy, John Gardner, Stokely Carmichael, and Sergeant Shriver. Night Call, the new nationwide radio forum on important issues facing you and the rest of the nation. Night Call, each weeknight. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Colonel William Corson about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
Colonel Corson?
Del, I want to address this question specifically. I'm indebted for Mr. Schaefer. It shows a high degree of perception to catch the significance of both Korea and North Vietnam. I was at Panmunjom and actually used to take off my racetracks. I was a captain and drove for Admiral Turner Joy. And we found that when we were out there that the Chinese were actually the people that were determining how the North Koreans would in fact negotiate. One of the drivers of the North Korean delegation was the man from the Chinese Communist Politburo, and he was the man they had to clear with. Now, I would suggest to Mr. Schaefer a real significant point that today at Paris, Chuan Tui and Lu Duc Tho and Lau are remaining very aloof from the Chinese, and you find that the distinction between the Peking advocates of how the peace should be arranged at Paris and the Moscow advocates are quite dissimilar. In the South, at the present time, the National Liberation Front radio is not today broadcasting any of the information pertinent to what is going on in Paris. It's been a complete news blackout. And what I'm saying, Mr. Schaefer, is this, that the North Vietnamese have feared the Chinese for a long time. And one goes back to 1946 when Ho Chi Minh invited the French back for 5 years rather than to accept the Chinese in his country, which had been acknowledged by France at the time.
That's rather very interesting. One more question and I'll go.
Surely.
I think this is a bombshell. General MacArthur repeatedly said while he was in Korea, and from the news that we got at the time, was relieved of his post because he wanted to cross the Yalu River into Manchuria. Is that right?
Well, there were several other factors that are involved. I quoted a remark of General MacArthur's, one of his famous remarks, that there is no substitute for victory.
Right.
And I would submit that in an earlier time, in a more simpler context, in a war that was military with political overtones, as opposed to a political war with military overtones, that made sense.
Yes.
But today, I think that the American public must decide, as we play around on the periphery of political conflict, that you as a citizen, and I hope that if you have a chance to read The Betrayal, you will decide. And personally, as a former horror of the government, I would hope that you, Mr. Schaefer from Kingston, Pennsylvania, would decide what you think is a reasonable victory.
All right. Now,
thank you for calling, sir.
All right. Now, may I? That wasn't the clincher to the question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A few months ago, General Eisenhower suggested that the Vietnam War could only be won if we ignored the so-called demilitarized zone and penetrated North Viet territory. And I guess sort of you did answer that, but if you recall, General Eisenhower at the beginning said when he was questioned by reporters, when I say at the beginning, this is going back now about a year ago, that he didn't wish to comment on the Vietnam War, since, you know, he was out of it. He wasn't really aware or wasn't informed at the present time inside exactly what was happening. But then he reversed himself. I remember seeing it in the news before he went in for a checkup at Walter Reed Hospital. He made this statement. And this, I thought, was significant. And do you believe this was political, or do you believe that this is actually what he thought? He used this illustration, and then I will hang up, that if somebody came into his home, opened the door, came in, and stole some of their property or shot somebody in his home, that after they left his home and went off his property, that at the sidewalk he would have to stop and would not be permitted to pursue them across the street.
Well,
now, with that, I'll hang up and I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay.
Thank you for calling,
sir.
It was
very nice talking with you, Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Shaffer.
And I will read the book.
Well, thank you.
Good night.
Thank you for calling.
I would say that, one, General Eisenhower is very well informed. There is a strange band of brothers. There are three people who can talk to each other, and politically they were not very compatible when they were all in power, and that is the former President Truman and President Eisenhower and now President Johnson. These people belong to the most exclusive club in the world, and President Eisenhower is fully knowledgeable of what has occurred in Vietnam, and I think that his degree of disenchantment or his changed position is based upon the fact that he is a perceptive enough human being to know that what he is receiving from the field and what he has been told officially does not square with his judgment as a person with a great deal of experience. He knows that that what is being relayed to him by the subordinates, and they're not his subordinates now, is really an essence of dissembling, that there has been an exclusion of the facts, the harsh facts, to the commander-in-chief. And this is what's caused him, I think, to appear to take positions that seem to be contradictory from different times. But this is a matter of his perception of the evolution of the conflict.
We'll accept some additional calls. This is Night Call in New York, and tonight we continue with What Are We Doing in Vietnam? And our guest tonight, Lieutenant Colonel William B. Corson. Our national telephone number is area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. Remember, you may call collect, and we welcome your comments and your conversation. Colonel Corson will take our next call from Mr. Dennis Berger, who is hearing Night Call over WRVR-FM here in New York. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Corson, Colonel Corson.
Right.
Both our military and our political, quote, experts, unquote, and our media have put forward ideas which seem to me as a human being rather inverted in their logic. Ideas such as the basic idea that war, and especially the Vietnam War, is peace, and the idea that killing men and women and children means the eventual saving of the lives of these particular men and women who and children who may die. And I was wondering, first off, in my first question, what effect the war, the everyday fighting of the war, has on the men who, of course, the experts proclaim support our effort every day. They're the ones who know, although it's the experts, of course, who do the talking. What effect it has on them every day in their lives? And secondly, how do you think the process of this war is affecting them in terms of what's going to happen to them as they come back into our particular society?
Well, thank you, Mr. Berger. You're a very perceptive human being. 1984 may very well be here, where war is peace and all of the other things of Orwell's doublethink are involved. There is a very deep and a broad philosophical question raised by what you've said. I've been asked, what is the attitude of these young men? The Marines that I led in a combat line battalion, they looked at it almost the same way that someone who works in the abattoir. It was a job to be done, and they went ahead and killed. Now, the youngsters who worked in the combined action program, who worked with the people, developed a tremendous empathy with the people of South Vietnam. They could enjoy a degree of rapport that I've never seen equaled between two racial groups. Now, what
going to be the reaction after the war, I'd cite well, this is not a quote, but this was a circumstance in the betrayal, and I tried to write it. There was a young Marine. He's 22 years of age. His name is Melvin Morrell. He comes from Syracuse, New York. Now, Mel Morrell is a Marine, and I might add, and I add it because from my point of view, there's only one color of Marine, and that's green. But Melvin Morrell is a Negro, and he's not one of the light-skinned passing types. He's an extremely dark-skinned guy, and he and I are close, personal, human relation friends. Now, during the racial riots in the riots that took place in Detroit and Watts, or not Watts, but in Detroit in 1967, I can recall, and maybe this illustrates, and it's hard to answer your question quickly. Della told me, you know, answer the questions quickly, but the night that we were, one night I was in Mel's hamlet, which is Tuiloan. Now, this was a hamlet that had 3,000 people, and it now has 8,500 people. It's surrounded by Viet Cong hamlets, and it's a town that the lights are on every night, and during the Tet Offensive, they stacked up Viet Cong like they were stacking up cordwood. So one night, Mel and I were getting ready. We were going out on patrol, and I asked him, I said, "Mel, what the hell are you going to do when you get out of the Marine Corps?" I said, "You know, it'll never be like this again." And he told me, "Well, I hadn't thought about it, Colonel." And he said, "I said, well, you know, you could be a big man in the civil rights movement. You know, you're tough and you're smart and you're quick on your feet and you can talk well." And he said, "That's true." And I said, "What do you, you know?" We'd been looking at the Newsweek article, and I said, "What do you think about this cat, Carmichael?" And it was dark, you know. And in the dark, you know, all cats are gray. I had my camouflage paint on, and of course he didn't need any because he's dark as ebony. And he told me, and I think this is significant because this is a human being. This is a close personal friend of mine. He said, "You know," he said, "we got all these cats all juiced up. We got these PFs and we got these Marines all juiced up, and we're going to go out and get ourselves some VC tonight." He said, "But you and I are going to be up front, and we may very well get our fanny shot off." That isn't what he said, but I guess we're on the air. And he said, "That's where we belong, and that's the responsibility of telling people to follow you." And he said, "I don't dig this guy Carmichael. He got all those people juiced up, and when the fighting started, he was off dancing the boogaloo with one of his girlfriends." Now, what I'm saying indirectly is that Melvin Morrell is the kind of man who knows how to shoot. He's tough, and he's hard, and he's compassionate. Now, he was home on leave and spent a couple of days here with my wife and my family in my home, and his wife asked me, she said, and I said, you don't have to call me Colonel. I mean, it's Bill. And she said, "Well, why does he have to go back?" And I said, "That's his personal fight." He said, I told her, I said that, and this was his third extension to go back to Vietnam. Now, realize what this means to a young man. He's been in Vietnam for 27 months. And he said to me, or she asked me, "Why does he have to go back?" And I said, "Well, you ask your husband." Those 8,000 people look to this young American for honesty, integrity, courage, and justice. I've seen him dispense divorces and send people back and say, "Quit picking on your husband now. Get back there and be a wife."
Well,
now, so what are these people going to be? You tell me. I don't know. They're the most remarkable men I've ever known in 26 years of military service.
Mr. Berger, we will have to stop for a station identification. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, can I stay on?
If you'd like to, sir. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Colonel William Corson after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
Prophet Isaiah says, "Your cities are burning because there is injustice in your land, and the Lord will not hear you because your hands are full of blood. Now, I will interpret that to say the United States is on fire, its cities are burning because there's injustice in the land, and the Lord above will not hear the cries of people like Lyndon Baines Johnson because his hands are full of blood.
Stokely Carmichael quotes the Bible in support of militancy. And a National Guard commander says ballots, not bullets, are the best ammunition.
I think you have a tremendous power in the democracy of the ballot box. It's much stronger than bullets. You do have the ballot box, which is far stronger than any sort of suppression.
Night Call, the new nationwide call-in show on vital issues, each weeknight on this station. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Colonel William Corson about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
And a welcome to the stations who join us for the second half hour of Night Call. And just before we return to our guest, Colonel Corson, since we've been on the air, we have received calls from listeners who hear our show on all but six of the 50-station Night Call networks. So we'd like to know if anybody out there is listening to us on WMRP-FM in Flint, Michigan, WLRC in Whitehall, Michigan, WFAH-FM in Alliance, Ohio, WFOB-AM and FM in Fostoria, Ohio, and KNOK-FM in Fort Worth, Texas, and KERI in Bellingham, Washington. And remember, we welcome your questions, your comments, and your conversations on our Night Call program. The telephone number, once again, is area code 212-749-3311. Our local telephone number in New York, 866-5010. And just another note, we like to be very, very courteous to our listeners. We certainly appreciate your call, but we're going to ask you to also be courteous to the other listeners and try to keep your questions short so that we can take as many calls as possible. Colonel Carson, you were addressing, or you were about to have a question addressed to you once again by Mr. Berger, who is hearing Night Call over WRVR-FM. Mr. Berger?
Mr. Shields, I'll make this as brief as I can.
Okay,
so that
fine.
Other people may call in. Colonel Carson, briefly, I'd like to respond to what you've just said. I think the content of your analysis of my question is in and of itself very Orwellian, because I think that you have depicted a situation in which a society, American society, in the 20th century, as technologically advanced as it is creating men who have to become fodder or transport their compassion, their love, their brotherhood, their sense of honor and respect for other human beings across the world and implant their cultural footprint, implant their human resources in another society when, of course, their struggle is really here at home to try to end the kind of brutalization that's being extended. And I think, the logic of what you're saying is basically it is very vicious. Because, as you said, the man kills well, he is a hard fighter, and at the same time he's compassionate, which of course seems to me to be illogic. But my final question is this, although there are hundreds, and I certainly wish we could meet, personally, what are the true facts about Khe Sanh? And what really went on? Because I know that for about a month or a month and a half, the American public was watching television day and night, night and day, to wonder if the base would be overrun. It was defended with everything the Marines seemed to have. Men were turned out in the cold who came from the South Vietnamese Army. Then all of a sudden, we get this incredible logic from the military and our quote political leaders, who seem to be more militaristic than anybody else, that it's not really worth defending and that we should leave.
Well, you raise more than one question. You raise a whole host of philosophical points, but I would submit that the Vietnamese were never confused. There were many leaders of the Vietnamese forces who said that they couldn't see the strategic significance of Khe Sanh. But it's part of a larger problem that beginning in 1965, when American combat forces went into Vietnam, and this is a gross oversimplification, Mr. Berger, but I do it for brevity, we put the prestige of the United States on the line. Khe Sanh was a complete accident.
The first Americans who went into Khe Sanh, I put them there, and they were three Marine Combined Action Platoons because this was the capital of the Bru tribe. Now, the Bru tribe stretches back into Laos, and it has some 50,000 people. But at Khe Sanh, this is the capital of the Bru tribe.
It seems like a wasteland now.
Well, that's right, except for the fact that the simple little CAP platoons are still located up there, and our idea was to protect the women and the children and the people who were trying to establish or maintain some continuity of the Bru tribal customs to prevent them from the incursions of the predatory raiders. Now, this wasn't a military activity. Then in the spring of 1967, the North Vietnamese began to move in this area, and we brought a battalion. The Marines brought a battalion in. And from this Topsy-like arrangement, we found ourselves committed to a series of strong points that were a commitment of the prestige of the United States. Now, we didn't want to stay there. The Marines didn't want to stay there. The CAP platoons could stay because of their particular function. And we found ourselves locked in. It's like marrying some woman who looked real pretty, and then you found you had your mother-in-law, then the mother-in-law's sister came in, and pretty soon you had the whole damn family, and you just couldn't get away from it.
And thousands of people died.
That's right, and thousands of people died.
Mr. Berger?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shirley.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling.
One question, Mr. Corson, where do you live?
I'm sorry?
Where do you live? Are you near New York?
I live in Chevy Chase, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C.
Right.
3214 Pickwick Lane.
3214. Do you welcome guests?
Pardon?
Do you welcome guests?
Well, certainly. I'm very open-minded about guests.
Just ask before you drop in.
Right, I will.
Thank you so much, Mr. Berger. This is Night Calling New York, area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. Remember, we welcome your calls, collect, and please, we're asking if you'd be kind enough to make your questions short. Our producers are on our backs tonight because the calls are really backed up. We'll take our next call from Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Kidd is listening tonight. Call over WLRF-FM.
Good evening, Colonel.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, Dr. Kidd.
I have a question, a little background. I spent a year at Vietnam as a battalion surgeon with a Marine unit and had a very large MedCap program, which you're probably familiar with in the Air Corps.
Yes, indeed.
And I wanted to ask you if you think that the war is being lost, the war for the hearts and minds of the people. Do you think that the war need have been lost if proper understanding and motivation of U.S. troops have been undertaken?
Well, to your first question, I think, yes, the war has been lost, and to your second question, I don't think that it needed to be. I've got a real soft spot in my heart, really, about the Navy Hospital Corpsmen. They were, as you well know, an integral part of the Combined Action Platoon program, and MedCap was the one action that we could undertake without getting any bad feedback from the people, because the Navy Hospital Corpsmen and some of these, not some of them, but all of them, were really giants among giants. And what these kids did in the 80-some hamlets we were located in is fantastic. You know, there aren't many people that have been confronted with the problem that you have if you've been a battalion surgeon. And I've tried to liken for the American public the problem of triage. You know, the idea where when they bring in the wounded into the field hospital, that you, as a physician, have to make that tough decision, you know, the can be saved, the walking wounded, and those that can't be saved. And I know too many Navy doctors, And I look at them and I say, that kind of courage, that kind of moral integrity to put everything behind the guys that can be saved and say to the others and just let them die with no assistance at all. And the whole aspect of triage I apply to Vietnam.
I was just going to ask if you apply that to Southeast Asia.
Well, I do it not only to Southeast Asia, Dr. Kidd, but I do it to the United States' role in foreign affairs in general. In Vietnam, to take the metaphor, I'd say that the three categories of wounded are the people, the Arvin, and the GVN. The people I know, my Marines proved it, and I'm convinced that they were not deceived. The people can be saved. The Arvin, from my experience with the Popular Force soldiers and with other elements of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, they can be saved. You give them that damn Band-Aid, Doc, and you bandage them up and you say you're fit for duty. But the government of Vietnam, from my point of view, can't be saved, and I say let them die.
Well, how do you propose to let the government of Vietnam die without letting the people of Vietnam die? Because I don't believe the people of Vietnam particularly wanted a communist form of government.
No,
I think they had rather been left alone and form their own government, but they have to choose between two people whose wills are being forced upon them.
Well, this was what Cap tried to do. And, of course, officially, that wasn't the wisdom in Saigon, but generals like Lew Walt and General Krulak and Nickerson said, you go ahead and run it. And our approach was, and this was my approach in Vietnam, was you don't need the government of Vietnam and you don't need the communists. Stand on your own two feet and God will help you do it.
Well, that never was.
Dr. Kidd?
Well, we had some people down at Chulai. I had Bob Day down there. I was spread all over the damn five northern provinces from Quang Tin all the way up to Khe San.
Well, I had a small place down at Kiha Island at Chulai, and it was very gratifying to work with the people.
Dr. Kidd, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll take our next call from Miss O'Donohue, who is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. And she's calling in from Madison, New Jersey. Welcome to Night Call.
Well, thank you very much. I'll try to make my comments as brief as possible.
Thank you.
Well, first, the Spock trial that went on in Boston, I think that was quite a farce. First of all, to call it a conspiracy when they had to introduce the men to each other. Well, what's your opinion on the Spock trial?
Well, I've tried to... is it Miss Donohue or Mrs. Donohue?
Miss O'Donohue.
All right, Miss O'Donohue, I think that Dr. Spock, I used his book, and I still have him around to take care of my own kids. But Dr. Spock is not very effective in terms of how do you protest. Now, as an American citizen, you as an American citizen, you can be more effective than Dr. Spock. And you can be more effective if you, in fact, will attempt to inform yourself of really what the issues are and then demand of whoever the public officials are you're concerned about and demand that they tell you how they're going to do something. Not what they want to do, but how are they going to accomplish it. And I think that the protest in the abstract, this is a fine representation of democracy, but it's not very damned effective.
Well, my second question is about the elections that took place in South Vietnam. Well, from your point of view, were they on the level? Because I heard some...
No, Mrs. Donohue, they were a fraud. And if you have the opportunity, read the betrayal, and I've set forth the facts of the fraud. But if those facts don't impress you or they don't make any impression, I would only refer to the comments of the elected vice president of the government of Vietnam, who said, and this was Nguyen Cao Ky, who said, and he was quoted, and he was willing to be quoted, he said the elections were a fraud, and they were only carried out for the, to placate our American masters, close quote.
Well, another thing, a friend of mine who served in Vietnam, he saw that some people, the votes that were cast for the peace candidates were being taken out of the truck, and the votes for two and three were put in instead of them.
Where are you from? Where's your home? I missed that.
From I'm from Madison, New Jersey.
From New Jersey?
Yes.
Well, you had a there have been some people in New Jersey that are not very savory politicians, and I would say that the entire Vietnamese election was like the elections when Boston, when Jim Curley ran, when he was still behind bars. You voted early and you voted often, and there was no question this election was a complete fraud.
Miss O'Donohue, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Colonel William Corson after station identification. Black is a red-blooded American color. The black showed the color of his blood in places like Vietnam and Korea and every other all-American battleground since the Revolution. Every time his country calls for help, he hears, but we don't seem to hear him when he calls. If black and white would listen with their hearts, they could hear each other. That's what Night Call is all about. It lets people air their views man to man, color to color, live from phones anywhere in the country. A syringe full of junk bites into black and white skin with the same ruining surge, and a black mother cries over her child just like a white one does. The problems are the same. The characters just have different colors. Night Call's person-to-person nationwide radio hookup lets the black and the white tell it like it is. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to Colonel William Corson about what are we doing in Vietnam. Again, Del Shields.
Colonel Corson, just prior to station identification, you mentioned that the work of Dr. Spark was possibly ineffective and that the average citizen should get himself together in terms of finding out what is going on in Vietnam. And yet we are aware of the fact that we are told that most of the news coming out of Vietnam is managed news, that we are not actually getting the truth. So what course is open for the average individual?
Well, Del, I've been on several seminars, and I've found that the press has been given a severe degree of chastisement, you know, that they're pinkos and they're sabotaging the U.S. effort. And this is categorically incorrect. Now, I've spent a lot of time in Vietnam beginning back in 1951, and I found over the evolution of this war, and particularly in my last tour out there, that the most informed people about this war were the members of the working press. Now, not the people who sat in Saigon and went to the 5 o'clock Barry Zorthian Follies where they were given the handouts, but the working members of the press who got out and they talked with people and they went to the source and they gathered the information. Now, there are difficulties, and every American has difficulties in trying to understand what the hell's going on. And the two difficulties from the press point of view, and I left out, I had written a chapter and I removed it from the betrayal about the press because I felt that this was more appropriate for them to discuss. The first limitation is the limitation of the censorship at the source. Now, General Westmoreland had issued an order that applied to all of the Army people that the only time that an officer could discuss an operation was when public information, a PIO officer was present. Now, this is a severe constraint. Now, that's censorship of a kind, because if an officer criticized, he found himself in serious problems from a disciplinary point of view. The second problem is the limitation of the media. Now, if you watch television and you watch the picture of it, you see a 3-minute film clip. Now, that doesn't tell you the whole story. Then when you read, take a paper like the New York Times, John Randall, who's a close friend of mine, was very distressed that a story he wrote, a detailed story on pacification, was cut down to 1,000 words. And John Randall said to me, he said, this is a complex issue. And why did they edit me down? Now, these are all limitations. But the individual who reads, a guy like Bill Tuohy from the Los Angeles Times, Ward Just from the Washington Post, John Randall from the Times. These people, if you read them over time, provide you with a complete story, and from this complete story. But you can't read one story and then not pay any attention, and then read somebody else who is less, or the Associated Press, a wire service. But you You know, you find a responsible correspondent, and then follow what this guy says, and the picture is there.
We'll accept some more calls. This time, the Castro Kid is calling in from Portland, Oregon, over from radio station KLIQ-FM. Welcome, sir.
Yes. Hello, Colonel.
Yes.
I think you are to be congratulated in your courage in bringing out such a controversial book, and if memory does serve me correctly, I think you are approximately the third in a line of great Marine officers who have done this. I think I would even go a little bit further than you. I think that the American, while he is mighty, he is not the almighty, and I have often said that there are two ways we can get out of Vietnam. One, we can go before the United Nations and say, I'm sorry, we goofed, and try to get out gracefully, or two, we can continue our present course and be carried out. And the way it looks now, I think we're going to be carried out, but the question I would like to put before you is, on various right-wing groups in this country, they have been pursuing that if we really wanted to get in and win, I don't know what they want to win or what they hope or expect to win, but we should bomb the dikes of South Vietnam. Now, what, in your estimation, would we accomplish by bombing this? Would it have any military value, any strategic value? What would it actually do that we haven't, what would it accomplish that we haven't done already with our saturation bombing and napalm?
It would accomplish nothing, and you would literally inherit a world that would be a rock ash, and it would not be to the United States' interest, from my point of view, to do this. I think that to engage in the type of punitive activity, the punishment would be contradictory to the best interest of the United States, not only in Vietnam, but for the rest of the world.
But you think that this would be of no military value at all to bomb the dikes and completely inundate South Vietnam?
No, indeed not. You see, one of the things, I raised the point in my book that the bombing of North Vietnam, literally, it doesn't work. It doesn't stop infiltration. That's point one. The second thing is that, and this is a really more relevant consideration, is the fact that it causes a solidifying of the hawk view in North Vietnam. Now, I said that there's an old saying up at the Naval Academy, and I was privileged to teach midshipmen, that when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
Mm-hmm.
And really what occurred was a hardening of the morale and the condition in North Vietnam as a result of our punitive bombing. And today you find thousands, tens of thousands of these individual shelters throughout Hanoi. Charles Collingwood saw these things, so they're in tremendous amount. And unless we're prepared to say that the 17 to 18 million people that live up there are going to be wiped out by nuclear weapons, this is absurd.
In other words, this action that we did solidified the country, the civilization.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, it quieted the potential doves who were more oriented towards an attempt of achieving a negotiated peace than any other thing that we could have done.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling,
thank
sir.
Thank you for your time, and I want to congratulate you again, Colonel.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Our next call is from Mr. Johnson, who is hearing Night Call over WSBT in South Bend, Indiana. Welcome to Night Call, sir.
I have been enjoying the discussion thus far, and I've been enjoying the forthright answers I feel the Colonel has been giving. One question that I have that has been discussed in the news media as well as in some academic circles is this idea of whether or not a military victory is out of place in today's world. Looking at our involvement in wars from a historical standpoint, it bothers me personally to see our country in a situation like Korea, and again like Vietnam. And I wonder, Colonel, how you feel personally about this idea of whether or not military victory is still something, or could still be an objective in today's world.
Well, Mr. Johnson, I hope you'll have an opportunity to read The Betrayal, because I think that the decision in this regard is one that you as an American citizen is going to have to make. I pointed out, I was talking to Dr. Kidd a little bit earlier about triage, where you talk about people who can be saved, those that are the walking wounded, and those that can't be saved. And I think that America in the future, and whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, and I could care less, you have to decide what areas you want to bring your power and your force to bear. Now, you have to be careful that you don't get hung up on Senator Fulbright has called the arrogance of power. We can't save everyone, and we obviously cannot engage ourselves in unlimited military operations. We have to say India can be saved, Pakistan can't, or Venezuela can be saved, and Guatemala can't. We have to make these choices. Now, military victory, I'm a trained economist, and I've also been a military man for a long number of years, and there are two areas I think that the layman sticks his nose in. He said he's his own military strategist, and he's also his own economist, because he's involved in both these things. And this is not an unwarranted situation. Now, I would appreciate your vision of what military victory entails. I mean, what do you want your nation to be doing in Asia is really the relevant point. Now, for 25 years, I was a whore. I did as I was told, and I fought the Cold War. Now, if you say, in your wisdom, after you look at what you want your nation to do in Asia, okay, we can tell you what it'll cost, and then we can say what the benefits will be, and you decide at the ballot box and in your bugging of the political candidates that I don't like that benefit, I want this benefit. Now, maybe that's too oblique, but I think we have something, we have something going for us still.
Mr. Johnson, I'm going to thank you for calling. We don't have too much time, and I want the Colonel to give us a wrap-up. Thank you so much for calling, sir. Colonel, we have just about, about 30 seconds, and if you could continue to pursue the thought that you were giving Mr. Johnson, I think that would be an apropos wrap-up for tonight.
Okay, Dale.
Now, you were mentioning that we would have to decide exactly what we want in Vietnam or what we are to get out of Vietnam, and this particular thought has not as yet been expressed.
Right.
Well, where do we go from here?
Well, Dale, you come back. I don't like to speak in cliches because these are...
Colonel Carson, I'm sorry. I threw it at you just before we are due to go off the air, but we want to thank you so very much for being such a kind guest to us tonight on Night Call. Thank you very much.
Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, What Are We Doing in Vietnam? Part 5. A balanced view with former Vietnam war correspondent and Saigon State Department official John Mecklen. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, and National Urban Coalition.